Hello and welcome to the Can of Fodder podcast. I'm Daniel Barnes, sometimes known as the hyena. There's a line from this film, the movie we're reviewing today, Tookie Pookie. One of the immortal lines of cinema, and it applies, I think, to the time it was made. It applies to now. This is what timeless works of art do. They apply across centuries. That line is, before we go, I've got to take a dump. As true today as when it was written and spoken and delivered to the audiences of cinema. Here's something else that's true and right and relevant. That's my co-host, Corky McDonald. Corky, how you doing, buddy?
In the immortal words of Moose from the John Travolta film The Fanatic.
Thank you for reminding me that movie exists.
I have to poo. So, you got to take a dump before we go.
Right.
I'm hearkening to another classic of the small screen. I don't think it ever got released on a big screen.
Yeah. The influence of this film we're reviewing today, it's you don't think of it as just an African film. This is a world film.
Worldwide.
This is for all of us. I've got to take a dump. Here's another dump, Corky. We did this a few episodes back where there's some films that we haven't reviewed yet on the show. We haven't canonized, but we've both seen them.
Yeah.
Probably many times.
Numerous times.
Certainly
yes.
In the case. Yeah. And they're kind of no doubters. They're first ballot Hall of Famers. And so we're kind of like, let's not waste time. Let's just canonize these suckers. Right away, we may eventually come back and review it at some point. We got a request to review Casablanca, which we canonized a few episodes ago. But it's just sort of like, well, why wait? Why wait?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Let's just get to it. So we got three more movies. We're just going to, boom, pop them right into the canon. We've got those wicks. We've got those, like, wicks that... They're like the party trick wicks on the cannon, you know, like they never go out.
Right.
It's hilarious. The cannon keeps firing and firing and firing.
The hilarious cannon firing. What we all.
Oh, my God.
Know,
that so many people reference. Have died laughing, literally died laughing. But we found three more movies that we wanted to just canonize right away. Let's start with one that I'm sure we've both seen like a thousand times, because this literally ran nonstop during the Christmas season during our childhood, and that's It's a Wonderful Life by Frank Capra, starring Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, great cast. It's kind of underrated and a little forgotten today, like how ubiquitous this movie was in an era kind of pre-cable. You got three networks and a few UHF stations, but It's a Wonderful Life was always there, always played. And you know, it all these years later, it still holds up.
Ironically, I never saw it as a kid. However, I had seen it pastiched in so many other things. Uh-huh. I pretty much saw it.
Parodied on SNL.
Oh, yeah. They show it in Gremlins, and so I know the climax, you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, and probably the one of these three that I've seen the most, even though I only started watching it as an adult because it's like a Christmas tradition.
But, yeah, and it's a film that I think speaks to adults more than children. It's also underrated, kind of like how dark this movie is and how tortured George Bailey's journey is.
Sure.
Even though he, spoiler alert, eventually figures out, you know what, it's a pretty good life.
And no spoiler alert.
Nay, wonderful.
Another spoiler alert is, you know, the other two movies by the what is considered the master of horror, this might be the most like grisly of these three. No, I think Psycho's got to be, but this might be the most like, you know, horrific, get you like, oh my God, questioning your own safety. And also the only of these three that I've ever seen in a movie theater. Something I've been thinking about lately is how many of these classic movies that I've my whole life considered one of my favorite movies. I've never seen Amadeus in a theater, but it's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Take the opportunity if you ever have it.
Go see it.
Go see your favorites on the big screen. Couple more by the master of suspense if not horror. We only have one Alfred Hitchcock movie currently in the cannon fodder canon. That's Vertigo, which we canonized. That was a great episode. Your first time watching the film.
Yeah.
But we both seen, too many times to count these next two. And amazingly, these were back-to-back after Vertigo. Vertigo 58, 1959, North by Northwest, follows that right up 1960 with Psycho.
What a heater.
By Northwest. Yeah, right? That's easy. You're on a roll. Solid. North by Northwest, that was like the summer blockbuster of 1959. Came out in July, and I think it was November of that year, he was already shooting Psycho. Completely different films, but they both really just show his mastery of visuals and sound and kind of the way a filmmaker can hold you in his grip and make you feel whatever he wants you to feel. Because he's just that good. Two great films if you've never seen them. I mean, really, if you've never seen them, please, come on. What are you?
Stop what you're doing right now. We'll allow it. Go ahead.
We'll allow it. Really?
But only if you watch all three in a row and then come back and listen.
This is self-care as far as I'm concerned. Like, you haven't seen North by Northwest, do yourself a favor and watch North by Northwest. So kaboom, kaboom.
And
kaboom.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's three more for the Cannon Fodder Cannon. 79 large. Yeah, three bells tingling, and a film gets its wings. But that's now 79 films in the Cannon Fodder Cannon, and potentially 80 as we get into this week's
episode.
So
we're only a third of the way to the 250, right?
Well, we've canonized some films that are not
in
the Sight and Sound as well.
And we've said no to some that are.
Yeah.
But we're going to build our own 250.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a good goal, right?
Right.
250 or 264 or whatever.
If I've done nothing else with my life, but I've built a 250 strong list of the greatest movies ever, I will consider that a success.
Yeah. Some people build like bridges or like, build companies. We'll build a list.
Some people run small B&Bs with their mother into Larry, California. And some, talk with their friends about some of the best movies. And you know what else some people do? Support those two friends talking about movies.
I love the boosters. They've got all the pep.
We're in between talking movies, and we're going to talk about you. Every single one of you out there that supports and donates to the show, we want to take a moment and say how much we appreciate you, how much we love you, and remind you that we could not do this without you. You turn on the lights, you turn on the computers, you pay for microphones, you pay for beer, you pay for everything that gets this review show going.
You are the lights. You're the light. You're our guiding light. Honestly, you're just a good, fine, godly people, as far as I'm concerned. That's just me. I got no sway with the actual God, so I want to hear about it. But if you'd like to donate to the show, if you'd like to be a good, fine, godly person, and my God, don't you? Head over to daredaniel.com. You'll find the answers there, and you'll find the menu at the top of the page. Click support the show. Any contribution helps keep this show on the go.
Now let's talk Tookie Bookie. The IMDb synopsis for Tookie Bookie? Maury, a cowherd, and Anta, a university student, try to make money in order to go to Paris and leave their boring past behind.
Yes, this week's film is Tookie Bookie. Tookie Bookie is Wolof for Journey of the Hyena. film stars Mage Nyang and Marimé Nyang. No relation, I don't think. Written and directed by Senegalese filmmaker Jibril Diop Mambete, one of the most important and influential African directors of all time, mostly on the basis of this film. He's also the uncle of filmmaker Madi Diop, herself a trailblazer. She was the first black woman to have a film screened in competition at Cannes. That was Atlantic's in 2019. Mambete started making movies in his early 20s with no formal training, and the 1973 film Tuki Buki was his feature-length debut. Most films made in Senegal at the time were made with assistance from the French government, but Tuki Buki was made with a $30,000 budget, partly obtained from the Senegalese government, made without any assistance from the French government, although it was certainly influenced, Mambete was, by French New Wave cinema. That's certainly what I think. It was also influenced by African oral traditions. The hyena is a popular folk character known for causing mischief and cheating to get what he wants, and that's sort of the journey of our hero Mori. That tension between the old and the new, between the newness of French New Wave cinema, the oldness of these African traditions, I think that aligns with this complex portrait of Senegal that we see in the film. We see a country tied to traditions, but there is also this hegemonic modernism constantly creeping in. For good or ill, probably mostly ill. Tuki Buki premiered in May 1973 at the Cannes Film Festival. Kind of faded into obscurity in the decades following its release, but it was restored in 2008 with help from Scorsese's World Cinema Project. And in 2013, it was added to the Criterion Collection. It placed it at number 66 in the 2022 Sight and Sound Critics Poll. That was after being tied at number 100 in 2012. So this is one of the films that's on the way up, as we've talked about some of the movies that have kind of fallen over the years. Major cultural influences, certainly on cinema, but also in pop culture. Note the use of the bullhorned motorcycle by Beyoncé and Jay-Z for their 2018 concert tour. Corky.
Yeah.
You have gone on the journey of the hyena. I've gone on the journey of a hyena. This is a journey that we've traveled together. How did you feel about this journey of the hyena? Did it reflect all your experiences as a hyena? Sorry, that was complete nonsense. I have nothing here.
I gotta tell you, I put this movie on after fixing myself a nice big plate of meat blanket, which is just ground beef and gravy over rice. And hoo boy, the opening 5 minutes of this movie.
Yeah, that's not something you want to eat.
Nope.
Put away the snacks.
You don't want to be eating. You don't want to be looking. You don't want to be conscious of what is happening on screen.
It's incredibly upsetting.
And yeah. It comes back quite a few times.
Oh, yeah.
This movie is artsy-fartsy. A little too artsy-fartsy for me.
Yeah.
I think its inclusion and definitely its ranking, and this is where me and you don't like to do these kind of things, but I think there's a little recency bias to getting restored and kind of rediscovered and talked about that lands it on this when it's lacking. It's shapeless and it's nice looking for $30,000. What are you going to do in the middle of Senegal?
Yeah, it's a low budget movie.
Yeah.
And it's using a lot of the tactics of the French New Wave.
Very much so.
It's handheld camera, and it's doing it a lot for the same reason they did it, is that they didn't have a budget.
Yeah.
Right? Like, gorilla. How do we shoot a car crash when I have one car and I can't crash it?
So not for me. Not a movie for me. I appreciated a lot of what it did. I think was amazed by the sound use in this movie. And I'm not talking about like soundtrack. There is a leitmotif, especially every time they daydream about moving on, Paris, Paris, Paris. Mm-hmm. But there are sounds that just come out of nowhere. There's the sounds that you would hear, I guess, in everyday Senegal, where you're at, the call to prayer. You would hear just the revving of cars. It'd be quiet and it'd just be a screaming overhead plane. So I really liked that. Mm-hmm. The story and what they got up to, not so much. I think it was kind of like a, what's that movie? Is it Koyaanisqatsi? Is it the, what's the movie? Or no, Baraka? The one where it's just clips of from around the world. Like the, yeah. There's no story.
Koyaanisqatsi, Pawakatsi.
Yeah, something like that. I viewed it as that kind of thing for me. It really, that's what I took away from it more positively, was that it was just a clip of a time and place that will never be recreated, post-colonialization Senegal, but still living under the French influence in culture and means of living.
Yeah, I generally agree with you. The movie, it's, as the kids are known to say, a vibe. That doesn't mean it's a great movie, but it's definitely a vibe. You can't say it's not a vibe. And I think it's fascinating, as you said, as a snapshot, as a portrait of its time, as I said, this kind of portrait of a complex and a changing Senegal. Like, we see people living in shanties and lean-tos, right? Like they get all their water from one well, that whole neighborhood in Dakar, this giant city, right? But we also see other parts of Dakar that are very developed. Like, mm-hmm. we see corporate logos, a mobile, an ATM. We see all of this kind of modern creeping in, traffic and sort of a warmth replaced by a coldness. So it's really interesting, like, this portrait of like a vibrant community that has this really strong identity despite the economic realities of what's going on. And then you have these two young people and they're kind of outcasts. They're outcasts with their own people. They're outcasts with these other groups like students and other kind of people. And they're kind of this old and new, they're embodying, I think, this like old and new tension of it. So I think it's fascinating and I'm definitely glad I saw it, but yeah, I also didn't view it as canon worthy. It's the kind of film I think that like you wish Mombidi got the chance to make more movies.
Yeah.
As a first film, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you just say best first films or like what a debut, or like you wish that like somebody said, oh my God, that's amazing. And here's a lot of money to make your next movie because you're such a great talent. And we want to be in the Jibril Diop Mambiti business, you know, the way that like the Weinsteins did with Tarantino or, you know, other De Luca with Paul Thomas Anderson, right? Like you wish he got that chance.
Right.
But it's a great first movie, but again, you see so much talent and potential, but you know, it is what it is. Like this was the achievement. It wasn't the springboard to something better, which is really a shame because he obviously had a really unique vision of cinema and of his own country. It's rough. It's uneven. It's a debut film. So of course it is. That's right. Part for the course. But that's also why I got to say, like, it's just not canon worthy for me. What I think is interesting and sort of not as appreciated, like I've seen this just described as like a straight drama. It's a drama. To me, this is like such a mix of a lot of things, a lot of styles, as you said, sounds, visuals, genres too. There's a lot of really broad comedy, like broad yes. comedy, like that scene at the well where they're all at the same well. And you got to wait in line, but then one woman cuts in line and then two women are like slapping at each other. And then the guy tries to get between them and everyone's laughing. And it's really big, broad, almost kind of silent movie type comedy. And that's not the only instance of that. I look at the mailman character too.
Yeah.
He's a very silent movie type character. He never even says a word, right? But then there's also, you know, really disturbing moments. There's this whole kind of road movie structure to it, like a lovers on the run sort of, or lovers who want to be on the run. And then, as you said, through the soundtrack and also through the film, there's also this kind of spacey Afro-surrealism going on and a little bit of neorealism as well. Like, there's some scenes that feel very documentary-like, including the many scenes of animal slaughter.
Many
scenes of animal slaughter, many drawn-out scenes of animal slaughters. But that's... There's so many drawn out scenes in this movie. The animal slaughter is kind of the most notable because you're watching animals get slaughtered brutally. But I'm also like, that scene at the well also goes on forever. That parade scene.
Yeah.
It's like it alternates the same
two shots
over and over again. And it keeps happening. Even the off-screen shower scene where the guy spends like 10 minutes trying to coax Maury into the shower with him. It's just like, it's the kindest way of just saying, like, get the fuck in here and fuck me right now. Like, it is so, like, he is, like, he's not passive aggressive. He's aggressive. Passive.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. I don't.
Are you going to get a full wrestling match? Yes, you are going to get a full wrestling match. Also interspersed with full watching two people walk through a crowd of people. and you're just like, okay, you know, we could have trimmed some of this out. I think I got the gist of what's happening.
Absolutely. No, it was one of my major issues. It felt like there was like 60, maybe 70 minutes of movie in this 90-minute film. And a lot of it was just extending scenes on way past the point where they could have just stopped and it's over. But that doesn't mean it's not striking and unique and doesn't have its own, like, fascinating kind of like vibe to it.
There are time jumps that you question, like, wait, where are we at now? And did this happen before or after? There's a lot of subversion. Like, I think it must have been pretty striking in this predominantly Muslim country in 1973 to have a flamboyantly gay character who's not, I mean, he's aggressive, but he's not like evil. You know what I mean? But he's also sleeping with the police, and that's really subversive, right? So be like, these positions of authority, oh, they're all in it together. There are broad moments, like the other police officer who's out there directing traffic, another scene that goes on way too long. But then you kind of get the idea, is he gay too? Like, he can't talk about where he met this guy and tells him to get away, his job, he might ruin his job.
Yeah, and his relationship with Anta, so this is our leads, our outcast, Maury the cowherd and Anta the university student. And I don't know, their first meeting has this kind of surreal feel because he is like attacked and dragged through town, like beaten up by a gang. As motorcycle is defaced and he's left for dead, and then she just appears, hovers over him naked, dressed exactly like him.
Yeah,
it's basically like almost like he's split into kind of a separate gender, right? But they're dressed exactly alike, and she sort of revives him. But yeah, he is kind of ambivalent about her in paying attention to her. After that,
it's odd. It's unique too. Like, it takes from the French New Wave, which is interesting because, you know, a French colony, the filmmaker is using Senegalese griot techniques and traditions, with the time jumps and stopping, introducing a character, but not fleshing them out until later. But also the French New Wave, like the guerrilla filmmaking or using experienced actors in several roles. Like, you want to talk about looking in the camera, there are so many.
Yeah, I know, right?
People just stare directly into the camera.
Never seen anything like it. No, it kind of reminds me of, like, if you can go on YouTube and see some of those like silent films where it's like 1899 on Market Street.
Yeah.
And it's just the camera like slowly moving down the street and everyone's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
What's following me? Like, what is this? And kids are like peering in the frame and then appearing in frame again, and they're out of frame, they're in frame. Yeah. So
they keep waiting for the camera to do something. Like, it's just people like, leaving
what
work.
What does this do? Yeah. And you know, as we said, like the his character kind of embodies, as we said, like old and new, right? Like old because he's part of this tradition. He's the hyena. He's mm-hmm. this trickster character who tries to like get ahead by tricking people and stealing and doing whatever he wants. And that's what we see. Like he tries all these different things just to get money so they can go to France. Like that's the ideal, is they're going to go to Paris and that'll be, you know, that's their new life. And first there's like a 3-card Monte style game and he tries to cheat at that and it doesn't work and he gets chased off. And then they try to steal some money, but they steal the wrong case. Yeah. And then it's like, they try to, the gay guy, and he's not sure like what he'll give him some money, but then he steals all his clothes and yeah. put on the clothes and everything.
And his car.
Yeah. But then there's also, as you said, this repeated refrain of Paris, Paris, this really kind of, you know, catchy but really silly song that's just like, you know, Paris is the place to be, right? You know, and so Senegal, of course, a French colony.
Yeah.
At this time, they had become a republic, but there were still a lot of ties to France. And the song, Paris, Paris, this version is actually sung by Josephine Baker.
Right.
Josephine Baker, the American, black American outcast,
yeah.
who kept her career going by moving to France and to Europe. And I think in that, you see this tension about like, France, Europe, but in general, but France specifically being kind of established in a kind of pernicious way as like the ideal of culture,
yeah.
as the ideal of happiness, you know, and that sort of draws them there. Like they steal the clothes and they put on the clothes of like the colonialists, right? They put on very stylish kind of clothes, or really old fashioned clothes for 1973. And they just have this desire to get to France. Like they just are to assume that like everything will be, you know, great in France. And that's the song like calling to them, you know, a black woman, you know, saying come to France.
Yeah.
And so there is this kind of tension about like, how French are we, you know, how Senegalese are we, how modern are we, how traditional are we? And I think that kind of plays out through the entire film. And that to me was like the most interesting part, besides, as I said, that mix of genres and styles. But we really should mention, if you have a problem with watching,
yeah, if any animals
get their necks slit and bleeding out for like 10 or 15 minutes, just be forewarned. That happens.
It comes back several times. And I'm not just saying yeah. like one scene, different animals get killed throughout.
Yep.
And you don't just see like, okay, they just stab it in the neck. No, like you're seeing this poor thing get led into the slaughterhouse. It's a slaughterhouse. So there's other animal detritus everywhere, blood everywhere. It's just yeah. rough. I had to look away at the beginning. And then when it kept coming back, I'm like, come on, I get the fucking point.
No, I get it. And as I said, there's so many scenes where you could say, oh, I get the point,
yeah.
move on. But they don't involve animals getting their necks slit.
What was the whole body in a trunk thing? Like, what was that?
That is a great question. No idea.
Okay.
No idea. Yeah. Again, a weird scene that kind of starts as almost slapstick comedy. The taxi driver who's all nervous and carrying the trunk like the women carry the water jugs on their head. And like running out of their earths. But yeah, it didn't work. So that's Tookie Bookie. We won't go into all the ending of it. You know, if you're interested, you should discover it for yourself. But was there a scene, a shot, a moment, a character that we didn't talk about you wanted to bring up before?
Like when you talk about the vibe of it, I really liked the vibe of when they were daydreaming about being all like fancy schmants. They pulled up in their car with the American Stars and Stripes on it. And the whole village that they grew up in is so happy to see them after they've been denigrating them the whole time. And they're wearing their flash cash, pull out a wad, and they're just sitting there smoking. He's got his cigar. She's got her little cigarette, and everybody's genuflecting pretty much for them, dancing for him, singing their praises. I liked that scene. It was kind of like, I get what they're doing. Like, this is them fantasizing about coming back and, you know, being top dog and stuff. Striking visuals wise, I also liked him buck naked standing in the back of the Stars and Stripes car getting driven around. And he's just buck naked to the world announcing who he is, you know. And it's an empty road, so it's kind of like a futile gesture, but it's just a cool concept, conceived shot.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned in the opening, one of the most kind of memorable images of the film is this motorcycle that Maury's always driving around, and that Anta also drives and loses to
a caveman.
Caveman? Tarzan?
The only white character that
I don't know. It's lost me there. But the bike itself is very striking image. It's just a normal motorcycle, but it's got this skull of one of these oxes. So, like, I mean, is ox bulls? I don't know. Like, what exactly are these? Because, like, these giant cattle, and they have these
giant,
like, gigantic
horns.
Curved horns, and these big waddly necks, and all the better for slicing. But, one of the very striking images at the beginning too, of and at the end, of the kid riding the horse as they're herding these giant ox or whatever they are. But that motorcycle is a striking image, and it's very important because, like, he goes back for the motorcycle, right, and kind of mourns the motorcycle more than his loss of Anta at the end. Semi-spoiler alert.
Jay-Z and Beyonce did that, and then also Little Sims. She's a rapper from England. She had a video where they were riding around on one of those.
All right, Little Sims. Sorry, credit to Little Sims. That's not Chris Sims.
Not Chris Sims.
Phil Sims' son. No,
from the Unbuttoned podcast. He's going to rate Sims. Quarterbacks and then ride around on that motorcycle. Our like pop culture reference is so weird. It's like we're 50-year-old men. We like sports, so we know sports podcasts. We like films, we know these film references. Yeah. We like hip hop, so we talk about these rappers.
All right, let's remind everybody about our rating system. If we both think that this was a sound selection, then kaboom, right into the can of fodder cannon it goes. But if one or both of us think it was a wee bit slight, no cannon for you, but we will offer up for canonization a slighted movie, not in the Sight and Sound Top 250, that we would put in its place. So, Corky, I put it to you. Tukibuki, slight or sound?
We're going slight. No toques, no books, no bells, no blooms.
Oh.
Sorry, Way of the Hyena. It got a little too up its own ass for me. Great debut with some very striking visuals. And I really like the use of sound. I mean, that's my favorite thing out of this movie is the use of sound.
It is very interesting and unique. I also will call it a little slight. Like the film. I would recommend the film if you're interested in African cinema, but not canon worthy. Got a high bar for the canon, and it just, like I said, the unfortunate reality is that the follow-up film happened like 20 years later, and I haven't seen any of his other work, but it's not on anyone's 250 as far as I know. So that's a slight. That's actually two slights, so no canon for Tukibuki, although, again, happy I saw it. But Corky, do you have a slighted film not in the Sight and Sound Top 250 to put in its place?
I do. I have another featured directorial debut. It's a movie without a strong central narrative plot, but also kind of just rather follows characters around. A very religious enclave, although religious doesn't play a part in the movie, kind of like Tukibuki, religion is in the background, but it's not anything it doesn't influence the story or what they do at all. That would say the same thing. And it also has a very strong vegan or vegetarian message in the way some of the animal scenes are done. And now I'm talking about the 2004 directorial debut of Jared Hesch, Napoleon Dynamite.
Nice.
I really think Napoleon Dynamite is an underrated movie. I think when I say underrated, I think it's considered slight, but I don't think it's that slight. I think it's a really nice character study of everybody in it is an oddball. Nobody you'd probably want to spend time with in your regular life, but they all work together. And he bops around his little town, doesn't fit in at all, and finds like-minded people. And it also has a very unique dance scene, the way Tuki Buki did. So there's a lot of similarities. And I'm going to recommend Napoleon Dynamite for the canon. I think in 20 more years, this movie will be regarded as one of the best movies of the century.
Fair enough. And I'm a fan. That's a really funny movie. Very quotable. Jared Hess is, you know,
hasn't done shit since.
Last 20 years hasn't gone as well.
Everything that worked in this one, he turned up to 3,000 and it was terrible.
I can't even say if it holds up because I haven't actually seen it since it came out in 2004, you said?
Yeah, 20 years ago.
My impulse is no.
Yeah.
Really good movie, but slight for our canon. But you know what? Again, it's been 20-some years, so if I have a little extra time this holiday season, I'll pop it in the old... Well, you don't pop things in anymore, do you? I'll click on the thing and...
You might click. Starting again pretty soon.
I might, right? Yes, I know. Now Disney's getting out of the game, or it's going to be like a... Well, whatever. I don't want to... So that's a no-go for Napoleon Dynamite. But I do have one more film. Last chance to canonize something today to make it a nice even 80. That's really tempting for the OCD part of me, although I do also do love prime numbers, so 79 is great. Jesus. However,
you are conflicted.
I'm conflicted. I don't even know what I'm talking about. However, I'm still going to put up for a vote a little film called To Mama Tambien, 2001 film starring Alfonso Cuarón. Similarities to Tuki Buki? Let me list them off. Sun-drenched road movie? Boom. Young people on an escape fantasy? Boom. Erotic restlessness among rebellious youth? Boom. National or cultural identity, in this case the quote-unquote New Mexico, symbolized by President Vicente Fox? Check, check, and check, and don't forget that stylistically both of these films have a lot of verb and there's a very striking use of music on the soundtrack. E Tu Mama Tambien, and Your Mother Too. And Your Mother Too is one of the revelations. Spoiler alert. Two horny Mexican teenagers played by Diego Luna and Gael Garcia Bernal. This was the first time I think I'd ever seen either of them. This is like most anyone has seen either of them for the most part. They're left alone for the summer by their girlfriends. They pick up a sexy yet troubled and lonely older woman. That's Maribel Verdú. By making up a magical beach, and they all head out on the road to discovery, as you do on the road. Sexual discovery, personal discovery, political, social, class discovery, discovery about each other. Like Tuki Buki, it's a simple film, but it's also very rich thematically and stylistically. And it's Alfonso Cuarón, you know, and he had the chance to develop his gift, and he's just such a dynamic filmmaker. You really can't help but get lost in this film. Really wonderful film. It's not that he eventually became known for these like technological like achievements, right? Like Gravity and Children of Men, these movies that are like, oh, wow. This is like an achievement on a very personal level. And what are you laughing at?
No, because this movie is like late night Cinemax, like but like Citizen Kane level all time.
Right, you know, late night Cinemax. No, it's hot stuff. Hot stuff. I told you, Diego Luna and Gael Garcia Bernal are in this, right? The tension, the sexual tension, is palpable.
And let's not forget Maribel Verdú. You want to talk about a Vicente Fox. I mean,
whoa. Hey-o.
Ha-cha-cha-cha-cha.
Yes.
Dan, so the sound you're hearing is bells and booms because, fuck yeah, man. We're canonizing you two, Mama Tom.
Damn. Zazu. Stop playing that goddamn piano. I'm trying to listen to him. We're trying to canonize things. Daddy!
those pedals.
To be fair, that was awful. Really. She was playing the same song. She didn't get any better at it. She didn't get any better. At a certain point, give up.
He should have thrown that broken banister at her. And just, I'll give you a piano crash. She was. What if he did that? What if, like, he's so elated, happy, but, like, he hears one wrong tune. The whole neighborhood's there watching.
Right? That's when he freaks out on her. Stop with the piano! Thank you, everyone. Oh, what a lucky man. So anyway, that is an even 80. That's an
hey!
Even 80. Ichi Mama Tambien, our first Alfonso Cuarón film. Not our first Mexican film.
Nope.
Because, yeah.
Olvidados. And,
Los Olvidados.
And the other one. the one about the parties. Killing, Exterminating absolutely. Angels.
Exterminating Angel, yeah. Those were both Buñuel, but this is our first native Mexican filmmaker. Buñuel, of course, was Spanish, making films in Mexico. Mexican filmmaker making films in Mexico. And I don't know what Alfonso Cuarón's up to, but hopefully there'll be something new coming soon.
Yeah.
I have nothing to report on that end, but Ichi Mama Tambien's in the Cannon Fodder Canon, so let the cannons roar.
So that's what we thought about Tuki Buki, It's a Wonderful Life.
Psycho, North by Northwest.
Ichi Mama Tambien, Napoleon Dynamite, Shampoo, A Man for All Seasons. Great train robbery. But what did you think
Gremlins
about
Tuki
Buki? Did you watch Gremlins. It with us? Had you seen it before? That's right. We'd love to hear your take on the film. Leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dare Daniel Pod. Tell us your thoughts.
But now, Corky, guess what time it is? You didn't guess.
No.
It was too hard. He doesn't know. He has no idea what's going on. It's time to pick the film that we'll be reviewing in 2 weeks on our next episode. And of course, we leave that up to the random number generator gods. That's our... You know, that's our Muhammad.
Yes.
That's our Jesus. That's our, you know, that's
you
our.
You hear the call to prayer guy, right now.
Yes. Give me a number. I have a number. It corresponds to a list. And that list number corresponds to a film. And the film is Born in Flames. Born in Flames. 1983 film directed by Lizzie Borden.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, not the axe, Lizzie
what
Borden.
What a late stage
independent
move.
Feminist filmmaker, Lizzie Borden. No axes. Well, I haven't seen the film, so maybe some axes. Maybe but some no axes. One's going to die of an axe unless they do, because I haven't seen the film. Synopsis of Born in Flames: in near future New York, 10 years after the Social Democratic War of Liberation, diverse groups of women organize a feminist uprising as equality remains unfulfilled. Corky, you've ever seen Born in Flames?
I
you
have.
Seen the Lizzie Borden film?
I have.
You have seen Born in
Flames?
Yeah,
this is the one where Kurt Russell parachutes in to bring Donald Pleasance out.
Definitely, yes.
And meets Ernest Borgnine.
No, this is the film where he has to go to Los Angeles. He meets Steve Buscemi. He plays basketball for his life.
You're the only human on earth who could narrate the plot to escape from LA.
Hell yeah.
So
I've never seen Born in Flames either.
No, I haven't seen it. But okay, so you said she's a feminist director. Lizzie Borden.
Yep.
I'm imagining a woman who wears baby doll dresses and striped stockings with like fake blood dripping from her eyes.
Nailed it.
That's how she
I'm looking
comes
at her
to
Letterboxd
set.
Picture right now. Wow. Perfect. The blood especially was just spot on. No. I've seen her film Working Girls.
I've seen that.
Which was made not you're thinking of a different one.
No, I've seen that. It's actually on like Criterion or HBO. It's about lesbian call girls, right?
Call girls, yeah, absolutely. Good call. So that was the film she made after Born in Flames. I think this was her
very low budget
first film. Yeah, so that was low budget. This is even more low budget, kind of an outsider film. But I've never seen it. I'm excited to see it. If you want to watch it with us, it is on the Criterion channel. Also available to rent or buy on all the usual VOD services. It's only 80 minutes long.
Jesus.
You can squeeze it in.
The Chris Sims podcast is longer than that. What are you
Thank
doing?
You. Baby Sims. I call them Baby Sims.
I call them Little Sims.
I call them Little Sims.
Until then, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram.
Like you Mama Sims.
Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. If you're a fan of new movies, listen to Daniel over there. Review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Kooky McDooty. That doesn't sound good.
Kooky McDooty?
Kooky McDooty. I should have workshopped that one.
Kooky McDooty. That was perfect. I'm Daniel Barnes, and until next time, save us a seat in the back row. Bye-bye.